You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. It's the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. And on today's show, we're going to be talking to one of the directors of the film Before Stonewall that came out in 1984. It's an incredible and fascinating look at LGBT history. Stay tuned. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Robert Rosenberg. He's co-director and producer of the film Before Stonewall, which opens this weekend at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
For sure. I'm excited to be talking to Santa Fe folks about the film.
Yeah, yeah. This film, it's a wonderful film. I saw it way back in the day. Seeing it again now, it's coming out on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot in New York City. The film actually came out first in 1984. And I think of this as a really important history that everyone should see, no matter what their age or sexuality. How did you come to make this film?
Well, I was a budding, aspiring young documentary filmmaker, and I had read some articles in the gay alternative press about people who tried to organize politically in the gay community back in the 1950s by a PhD candidate in history from Columbia, John D'Amelio. And I said, wow, I didn't know any of this. It was eye-opening. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to make a movie about this? And I moved to New York, got to know John. He let me read his PhD thesis, which became a famous book called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. And I said, this could be a movie. And I got together with the final collaborators, Greta Schiller, the director and producer, and John Scagliotta, the executive producer. We raised money and the movie got made. Sort of sometimes dreams come true.
Because the film was made in the 1980s, that means that you were able to talk to people who were born literally around 1900, who came of age as early as the 1920s. Those people are no longer with us. It's such an interesting perspective, an important perspective on how they experienced life. Tell us how, first of all, how you found them, and what are some of the kind of things that you learned? I mean, you were a young man at the time that you guys were in the film.
One thing is, most of the people who were interviewed for the film in 1983 have now passed on, 90% of them, mostly from old age, a few of the men from AIDS. And as you said, there were people, I think the oldest person was 91 who we interviewed, who was talking about the teens, 19-teens. Now looking back on it from today, some of those oldest people at the time were talking about a period that was 100 years from this moment we're at now. So it's a really important artifact in and of itself. A friend of mine who works for the Holocaust Museum in Washington came to one of the screenings here in New York, where I am right now, and said, it's kind of like that. We're rushing to get the final survivors, to get them on record, their stories, their archival materials, and you preserve that in amber, in a sense, on film in 1983. And if you went to try to make this film today, you'd have to reanimate those stories through actors reading diaries, and you wouldn't have the real people on camera. So it's amazing. You know, we didn't have the internet back then in 1983, so we had to find them in different kinds of ways. And also, the whole field of LGBT studies, queer studies, gay history kind of didn't exist. The people that we worked with as our expert, authority, scholarly advisors were primarily either community-based activists like Jonathan Katz or Joan Nessel in the Lesbian History Archives, who weren't really credentialed and were doing this as a community activity, or people like John D'Amelio, who was just getting his PhD. And today, you've got books and books and books on many of the subjects and many of the eras that we dealt with. But we were really blazing a new path, which now when I think about my being 28 when we made the film, was beyond audacious. I mean, we all feel like that. We can't believe we did this. But it was exciting, and we got the help of these people in the community, but it was all new. So we identified a lot of interviewees through these community sources, through these historians who did exist and were starting to work. Plus, we went around and put ads in the back of LGBT papers around the country, looking for home movies and photographs, looking for people to interview, and then we'd get recommendations. We divided up the country in different cities, and we went to different places to do research before we filmed everything. I did Seattle and San Francisco intensively, and I would contact community centers and say, do you have any more elderly people who come regularly who you think might speak on camera? That's definitely how I found a lot of people in Seattle and San Francisco who were not well known, who were just regular 70-something, 60-something, 80-something people who were out enough to come to a community center and considered, not always said yes, considered talking about their own lives as gay men or lesbians back in the 40s. So we got people like that. But of course, for their generation in 1983, they themselves were atypical. They were willing to speak on camera. Only the hope was they were atypical now, but maybe their lives they were talking about in the 40s and 50s themselves were typical of a more closeted lifestyle. So it's a range of people that we had.
One of the things that might be unbelievable to young people, I mean, there's so many things in the film that you watch it and go, oh my God, like being gay could have you committed to an insane asylum without anything else. I mean, no, just being gay.
Yes, I mean, compared to 1983, and certainly to 2019, women who love women, men who love men, who had sex with each other, who saw relationships with each other, who just socialized in that kind of subcultural climate, were very, very much subject to the threat of losing their jobs, to being institutionalized in mental hospitals, to being put in prison, to being shunned by their families, if not arrested or institutionalized. So it was very hard and very scary in some ways, in many ways, to be out even among your closest friends. But also, yet, in spite of that, one of the things the film shows is that there certainly were significant people, especially in big cities, who found a way to carve out a social space for themselves, a private space where they could exist and even be happy and find love and serious relationships and friends. George Chauncey, another very important gay historian who was not even working as a historian when we made the film, wrote a great book called Gay New York. And he said, yes, we think about people being in the closet back then, and mostly everybody was, but if they were in a closet, think of it as a very well-appointed closet with nice lighting and great curtains. Many people lived in that closet quite well, as long as they conceal themselves from the law, from their employees, and often from their families.
I was watching the film last night with an old friend of mine who is in her 70s, and she was talking about how back in the day, she was in Washington, D.C., and in DuPont Circle, you could like go and find your tribe. You could recognize each other. And there was kind of a confluence between the gay scene and a kind of bohemian scene where there was, I mean, it was a place that, you know, had to come about as a result of incredible oppression, but there was also a really kind of cool vibrance and excitement to it.
Well, it's kind of like being an outlaw, of being on the margins gives you perspective on the rest of society, makes you realize how so much of the way anybody lives is a performance, is performative. And yes, there was a lot of association for gay folks, for LGBT folks, however you want to call it. Back then, it's a different language, with the bohemian lifestyle, with artists. I mean, the word gay itself was originally used to talk about prostitution. So a lot of that existed, but only in major urban settings. To the extent the cities got smaller and veered into rural areas, a lot of that disappeared. But certainly, you know, back in the 20s, in places like New York, in San Francisco, in Paris, in Berlin, London, Los Angeles, there was that underground scene. but always with the threat of job loss, arrest, institutionalization, and censure by your family. And so many, many people passed. They got married, heterosexual families. Maybe there was something going on the side. Maybe they kept it themselves. So we have to understand that it is a sort of see the barn from multiple sides, so to speak.
Right, right. One of the things that was instrumental in more than one civil rights movement was World War II. So probably many people are familiar with the phenomenon of black soldiers serving in World War II, coming back and saying, look, we served our country. We're not going to go back to just kind of Jim Crow and taking that kind of abuse. There was a similar dynamic for gay members of the military. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a very astute connection to have made, because that's true, and I wasn't thinking about that so much. But World War II, this mass mobilization of people in the United States, mostly men but some women, who might have been leaving very small towns to suddenly be in contact with people from all over the country, and then going to Europe and, in spite of the war, getting in contact with Europe, really changed people's perspective. And as you say, black, mostly men, fought, and they weren't coming back to the United States being satisfied with the old status quo of segregation that had existed. And I think that was also what clearly was true for a lot of gay men and women, that they suddenly discovered, maybe coming from a small town where they knew nobody, that there were other people. They would often go and settle in larger cities and leave small towns to seek out a community. But you also have to remember there was a backlash. The women, they were called Rosie the Riveters, women who worked in the war industry in the States and the factories, who had never been kind of allowed to because men took the jobs before. They were kind of forced back out of the factories into more traditional homemaker roles. And the 50s became a very repressive time politically. The anti-communist hysteria of Joe McCarthy, which we clearly show dovetailed with an anti-gay hysteria about homosexual federal employees. So there was a backlash as well. And it wasn't until, you know, the early mid-60s that the real fruits of the World War II changes really started happening. And there were people like Allen Ginsberg and the Beat Generation, people who were busy in the 50s rebelling as well, but it was a much more minority perspective. And again, we show that artistic current of the Beats was very wrapped up with a revisioning of what it might mean to be queer that Ginsberg was doing in the 50s, that then became, I think of it almost like a prophetic voice, like it was prophetic and prescient for what would then happen from 65 to 69 with the huge upsurge in the youth counterculture and the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the gay movement.
And around that time, we were starting to see an end to censorship. I mean, there was a period in our history where any play or book, whatever kind of literature, film, that made overt references to homosexuality was censored. When that lifted, that was a big step forward as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a push and a pull. Again, in the 20s, things were a little bit more open, and then it got repressed. You know, it went back and forth, but the final dams began to burst in the 60s, leading us to the day that we're in now, the era that we're in now, when it's very free. But those were fought out very hard in the courts. And Ginsberg's publisher fought to allow his stuff to be published and that it wasn't pornography. One magazine, which was the only really officially gay male magazine published out of L.A., also fought a similar fight in the early 60s to allow them to mail their magazine out to subscribers. The Postal Service said it was illegal if it was pornography, and they won. So those were two major censorship battles. It's funny, it dovetails with the question we always get, was public television, which funded the film about half of the budget in 83, and they eventually broadcast it. Were they supportive of Before Stonewall? How did they feel about it? And in fact, it was the first major gay film, the first that they funded and broadcast. And watching it today, I thought, wow, it's pretty uncompromising. We were very aware that because they funded it and they had to show it, we couldn't cross certain red lines of explicitness. But it's pretty sexy. It shows people. I mean, it's pretty out there. They never really objected to any specific part of the film when they aired it in its whole, but they were nervous. They were nervous about being sued. They were nervous that affiliates would refuse to play it, even though it was a national broadcast, which can happen. They never got sued. They got many letters of complaint, but we never got sued, and they never got sued, and it turned out to be a success. Of course, there's no problem with this film today on public television, but at the time they were nervous, and it was the Ronald Reagan presidency at that time. And subsequent to them funding us, nothing like this got funded for a long, long time, because there was a kind of implosion about federal funding for the arts supporting controversial artists' expression about gender and sexuality. We happened just before that. We escaped that moment, but then things went backwards for a while.
One of the things that is so cool about the film is that there's a lot of footage of things like women dancing with women, men dancing with men, real old-time black and white films from, I don't know, the 20s, 30s. Some of it looks like it's even out of the silent era. Where did this all come from?
A real wide range of sources. So, the two big silent era material sources we use are actually queer specific. One is a film called The Florida Enchantment, which may not have been made by gay people, but was about a man who went to Florida, I think for his honeymoon, and ate a magic bean, which sort of turned him into acting like a woman. So, there's a bunch of stuff like that in there. So, it clearly was referencing trans. Gay and gender expression, more kind of as a comedy, and so hard to understand exactly what the perspective of the filmmakers were. The other film, different from the others from Germany, was made between the wars in Germany and is considered the first really gay positive gay film, and there's a bunch of footage from there. Probably both films were identified to us by Vito Russo, who went on to write a book called The Celluloid Closet that looked at representations, same-sex gay representations in Hollywood and other kind of film. And he, again, had not written the book yet, but had already been researching and doing kind of public talks and clip shows, which I had seen about that idea. So he identified both of those, plus The Killing of Sister George, which was early 60s, mid-60s, a lesbian film from England based on a play, and they shot a scene in a real lesbian bar with real lesbian patron extras plus the actresses. So that was in the film too. And some of the material is what I call recontextualized, reframed. It might be a film from World War II showing WACS, the Women's Corps, them dancing together at a women's club, and it wasn't really supposed to be lesbian specific, but in this context, it illustrated well. There might have been some lesbians there enjoying this dancing more than they were supposed to. So we recontextualize material as well. Most of the photos, especially the photos that looked like very personal photos, are actually photographs from people we interviewed, their home photos. You see a lot of people dating back to the oldest people, to the 20s for sure. Those really are gay men and lesbians, or sometimes famous people that we knew were gay, like a Gertrude Stein that we'd show a picture of, and those were real people.
What was the relationship like in that time in the early 80s between lesbians and gay men, especially in the kind of political movement for civil rights?
Well, there was a synergy or a back and forth between what was called the gay liberation movement in the 70s and the women's movement, but the gay liberation movement was very male-dominated for all kinds of reasons that you might imagine, and many lesbians went on to organize their own lesbian organizations in the 70s and their own lesbian institutions. I remember the Anita Bryant case was a real key thing. The Anita Bryant campaign in Florida to overturn the gay rights ordinance in Miami, which was about 1978, I think.
And for those ladies and gentlemen who don't remember who Anita or don't know who Anita Bryant was, she was the face of the orange juice commercials at that time. And so she had this sort of all-American kind of persona.
Yeah, a singer who's a singer performer, and then she lived in Miami and campaigned to overturn the gay rights ordinance, which she won. That act brought lesbians and gay men in the movement much more together, because it became clear it was against all of us in the community, and people who had stopped working together in the early 70s started working together more. So it wasn't odd for us as individuals to work together. I had always been involved with lesbian friends and supportive of women's issues. So we worked together and worked together pretty well. We all were committed to equal representation of women and men in the film and diversity of race and experience and all that kind of thing. And we brought Greta Schiller, who directed the film with me, and John Scalia, the executive producer. We brought all our perspectives and all our nuances and some differences to the film, and I think that really helped it. But it is a very carefully constructed, as diverse a film as we could pull off with our resources, and that was very important to us to tell a story that way.
So June 27th, 1969, and this podcast is posting on that day, the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot. Tell us what Stonewall was, how this riot happened, and the great importance of that. It really represented a turning point in the civil rights movement for LGBT people.
Stonewall, there was a gay bar called the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village in Sheridan Square in New York City, and it was raided. The police say now the raid was because there were problems with the licenses. It was a mafia-run bar, as most gay bars were back then, because it was sort of a criminal thing in most localities to have a gay bar. Some people say it was because they were supposed to be paying off the police, the bribe them, the mafia, and they didn't do their job. It's hard to know, but it definitely was perceived as harassment by the patrons. This kind of raids of bars happened all the time, and often the people who were caught up in that dragnet at the bar were arrested. Sometimes their names would be printed in the paper in many locations. They would lose their jobs. So the raids were conceived as harassment. And leading up to Stonewall in the 60s, in a number of localities, there had been some resistance to this kind of police harassment. Other kinds of small riots or protests, not as big. Somehow Stonewall became really big. They kind of lit the place on fire by throwing like almost Molotov cocktail type burning trash cans into the club and kind of barricaded the police in there, and the patrons got out so they didn't get arrested. And then for a few nights afterwards, people heard about it through a grapevine. It wasn't covered in the mass media. And some few thousand gay men and lesbians came down to the village and were wandering around and were angry in the way that riots and street activity starts. And it was the largest thing of that kind, and just became the spark, became a symbolic spark and a real spark that ignited a new kind of political action and a change in cultural consciousness. Within a year, there were like 50 to 100 new gay organizations organized around the country in communities and campuses, calling themselves gay liberation fronts or gay liberation organizations, kind of mimicking the language of liberation of the time of, you know, in the countercultural and the protest movements. And it's considered a symbolic beginning of the change for the mass gay rights, gay activist movements. And the film attempts to show how did we get there. You know, it wasn't just born that moment. There was decades leading up to that where people who had felt persecuted, maybe they were the only one, discovering there were others, discovering community, beginning to embrace their being gay as an identity, not as an individual quirk or problem or perversion. And once they embraced themselves as having an identity and having a community, people started to question, back to the 50s, even earlier sometimes, why are we persecuted? Why should we accept this? And with the 60s and the huge changes in the protest movement, the youth movement, counterculture, civil rights, anti-war, and women's movement, people just said, we need to organize. And it became a wildfire that couldn't be stopped. That leads us to 2019, where gay marriage is legal in the whole country, where, you know, there's still a lot of things that need to be changed around the world, but things have changed wildly and very dramatically in the last 50 years since the Stonewall riots.
Well, I was thinking about the difference between, I mean, that 15-year period between Stonewall 1969 and when the film came out, 1984. I mean, a huge change in terms of acceptance and civil rights. But then again, when I think about the difference between 1984 to the present, it's also another huge change. And I feel that your film was very much part of that. So many people saw it. And so many people, whatever their sexuality, began to kind of see the bigger context here and see the humanity of this movement and of these wonderful people. I mean, the people whom you show in the film are just so, so lovable.
Well, I think that it's really hard to, it's hard to get a historical perspective as a human being, even when you live through things. Like people keep saying, well, can you compare before Stonewall, when you made it in 1983, and to today? And it's like, wow, that is so hard. I think that the filmmakers, we filmmakers, and most of the people working on the film, we were all very confidently, like, confident about who we were as lesbians and gay men, confident and comfortable with a positive gay culture. We were children. In a sense, we were the children of the gay liberation movement and of the Stonewall riots. Even though it was only 14 years later, I came out fully in college, reading books of the gay liberation movement and reading feminist literature, and it all seemed natural to me. And that's what was fascinating about looking at Before Stonewall, because, wow, it was so different not very long ago, a few years ago, kind of. So the time between when we started filming in 83 and today seems big, but not as big as the jump from 83 to, let's say, 1963, only 20 years before. It doesn't seem as big, but I think if you're younger and you're a millennial, straight or gay, looking backwards, 83 seems like a long time ago, and you have Will and Grace and gay marriage and RuPaul. And so, you know, I'm on the streets in New York and I see electronic billboards promoting 50th anniversary of Stonewall riots. Let's celebrate LGBT history. And they have like famous gay New Yorkers like being on billboards. It's, that does seem slightly surrealistic and exciting. But I think people still need to know their history. LGBT folks need to know their history and have a sense of tradition and who our past was. And everybody needs to understand how sexuality and gender and so wrapped up the changes with the political and cultural changes of our world and realize who we were and what we're becoming. It's very gratifying to me when I speak to somebody who might be 35 now and say, you know, a straight woman and say, wow, I saw Before Stonewall in my gender studies class in college and it transformed my understanding of the world. You know, it's sort of like, wow, it's like you can't make up better testimony to the impact of a film.
And I think that it's really important. I mean, the way I think about it is that Black history is my history, even though I'm not Black, and women's struggles are also something that men should understand, and everybody should know gay history. We're all part of the same community and the same society, and all of our civil rights struggles should be known and understood and celebrated.
Absolutely. I don't think we do know enough about the detailed, granular stories of Black struggle in the United States, Black history, Black resistance, Black victories. All marginalized people in the United States are not fully represented in the official history books. But gay people is a whole other kettle of fish, because at the level of high school, LGBT history still is basically not taught. And, you know, we do teach now, at least in most places, Martin Luther King and the end of slavery. Just as an example, I think Latino history or Asian American history is less present. So there's still lots of struggles to include people who have been marginalized in the center of the story. And gay history is still just being done. Like at the university level, it's there, but in high school level, some people keep saying, why aren't high school people taught about Harry Hay and Barbara Giddings and Allen Ginsberg as a gay activist leader? Why are they taught that in high school? Well, change comes and happens and fits and starts, but I hopefully eventually everyone will be included in the stories that are told to young people.
Robert Rosenberg is co-director and producer of the 1984 film Before Stonewall. It opens at the CCA here in Santa Fe on Friday, the 28th of June. Robert, thank you so much for the wonderful film and for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.